For the week of September 10th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 380, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
So you escaped Irma, because I know that you were driving north as the hurricane hit Florida, and we had to delay our show, actually, one whole day, so that you could make it out of harm's way.
No. I wasn't in harm's way. Just wanted to avoid driving in rain. So I was in Alabama. They're just going to get a heavy storm. That's all. They're just fine. But I have lots of family and friends. I grew up in Florida, so I know all sorts of people in Miami, and I have a friend in Jacksonville. I don't know how her house is doing yet there. They had the worst flooding in 150 years. So there's flooding all over the world, of course. There's thousands of people dying in other countries like Bangladesh. There's, you know, terrible natural disasters everywhere. But of course, we're here in the U.S., so we see more about Harvey in Houston and Irma in Florida and the coastline going up to Alabama and Georgia and all that. So, you know, obviously we're thinking about all of them and all our friends. It's goofy, but I went on Facebook at one point to see, you know, who said they were safe. So I didn't bother them with texting, because you got a million people reaching out to you saying, are you okay? You know, they've got to clean up. So I went on Facebook, because they have that little handy thing where you can check in and say, I'm okay. So immediately they have a list on there when I go to Facebook of all the people who live in Florida that I am Facebook friends with. And they say, you know, Susie has checked in. She's safe. Joey has checked in. He's safe. And so on and so forth. Then you had some people who, like, eight people have checked in and said, are you safe? Because you can see next to the person, you can ask when their name is there. Even if they say they're safe or they say they haven't responded yet, you've got a button you can press, ask if they're safe. So I'm looking through that. I'm glancing down and I say, oh, this person hasn't checked in yet. They're probably fine. They're just busy or they don't have power. That person hasn't checked in. And then I saw a couple of people from high school that I'm friends with, and no one had asked if they were safe yet. And I'm like, oh, God, God. So, like, guiltily, I'm like, oh, my God. And I immediately check in and ask those four or five people. I mean, it just didn't happen. That's all. But, you know, so I'm like, are you safe? I didn't want them to feel like nobody cared. So I felt obliged to go on and check and make sure everybody was asked if they were safe, who was in my list. So a little bizarre, ridiculous Facebook guilt.
Well, you know, there's no power in most of Florida. It's coming on slowly. And so maybe their phones ran out of power, or they can't charge their phones, or they don't have access.
I'm sure they're all fine. I mean, though, actually, I have a friend who works at a firm where a coworker died in Atlanta. The one person to die in Atlanta was in their home. A tree fell on their home and killed them. And my friend knows them, works with them. So, you know, people say, oh, you know, of course we say we're lucky, because it the way it hit land, it could have been a lot worse if it had a direct hit on a major city. But of course, if your particular home is destroyed or your car is destroyed or you die, doesn't matter how everybody else is, that's a disaster.
That's true.
Yeah, it is. And it's a busy week. I'm coming up to New York, because I'm going to go to the New York Film Festival. They have the screening starting next week. And then about 10 days later, they begin the actual public screenings. But the critics start to go in the morning starting on Monday. So that's going to be a lot of fun. On Friday night, I'm going to go see Star Wars at Lincoln Center at the David Geffen Hall. They're showing Star Wars with the New York Philharmonic performing the score live in person.
Oh, wow. That should be fun. That's always fun when they do that.
It's really fun, and that's such a big score. I mean, you're going to be sitting there, and they're just going to go, dumb, and then they're going to start into the theme song, and the crowd's just going to lose their mind, because it's really it's really cool when that music hits you live. It's really exciting. And next week starts binge listening. I'm launching the world first binge listening party.
Okay, I don't even want to know what that is.
Yes, you do. Okay, you know what binge watching is, right?
Yes, I do.
That's right. Binge watching is where you gorge yourself on an entire season or an entire run of a TV show, or perhaps the director.
And you're going to be doing the same thing with a musical artist, maybe.
With music, exactly. I'm going to say, hey, we've all got access, a lot of us, to all these libraries, but it's so overwhelming. You listen to this song, that song, you jump around, you listen to the same 20 people you always listen to. People, they listen to playlists. They're not focused as much on albums anymore. And just like when you watch a TV show all at once, like Gilmore Girls or Freaks and Geeks, you can see strengths and weaknesses in the show you wouldn't appreciate otherwise. You know, when you watch it over 7 years, it's very different from watching it in just a 2 month time span. Same thing will happen with artists. So I'm going to start with Billy Joel. I was going to start with Steely Dan, but Walter Becker died, and that felt a little creepy. So next week, I'm going to start with Billy Joel, and I'm going to, you know, encourage people to listen to one album a day, or however they want to. But every day, we'll discuss a new album, starting with over the weekend, people will listen to his first two albums, Cold Spring Harbor and then Piano Man, and then Street Life Serenade, Turnstiles, 52nd Street, The Stranger, and on and on and on until we listen to all of Billy Joel's albums. Lets you pay attention to him, lets you use Spotify and Pandora in an interesting new way, focusing on the album, giving a tribute to an artist, seeing what their whole body of work feels like when you listen to it over a two-week span. And I'm starting with Billy Joel next week because over this weekend is the anniversary of when he recorded Piano Man, the song Piano Man. He recorded like Saturday through Monday back in the early 70s.
You know, I would have thought you would have started off with Stormfront, given the, you know, how we started this conversation.
Yeah, fair enough. But we're going to go in order from Cold Spring Harbor all the way to River of Dreams, listening to all his albums. So if you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you know, join me, join in on the Huffington Post or on Facebook and take part in the conversation. Maybe listen to an album a day when you go to work or during your workout or whatever it may be. It's a fun way to pay attention to an artist, you know, and give his body of work another chance if you've never really listened to him, or reappraise him if it's been a long time.
Well, I think that our listeners should binge listen to all of our episodes, all 380 of them.
Oh, God. Well, that seems cruel. But if they listen to all of those episodes and catch up to episode 380, what will they be hearing about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at why Spider-Man did so well in China, how Disney is keeping its Star Wars and Marvel movies for itself, thank you very much, and the reason Hollywood is blaming its poor summer movie season on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, who else are they going to blame themselves? During our book filter segment, Michael will tell us what book would be great for development by Hollywood, but he may be losing his mind. It's a cookbook, okay? How can a cookbook be turned into a movie? He'll explain. On Inside Baseball, we'll dive right back into Disney, which apparently is not the happiest place on earth. They can't seem to play well with others, or at least Kathleen Kennedy can't, and the studio has now fired or pushed aside four different directors on the Star Wars movies. Is there a problem, or is Disney just protecting its very valuable franchise?
Or are you sexist? That's just another possibility.
No, I'm just, I don't know how, I don't know where that came from. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office from around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit and Box Office Mojo. We love to send you those great websites and the number. We pull info from Variety and Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, you name it. And, of course, you, the viewers, when you chime in. And the box office results this week are in, and they're very exciting. It is the top grossing movie in the entire world.
Wow, okay.
It is also the top grossing movie in North America.
Cool.
And it set a number of records. It is the highest grossing September debut in box office history.
Well, okay, fine, but don't keep us in suspense. What's the name?
No, hold on. I'm not done yet. It set more records.
Okay.
It was also the highest grossing fall debut of all time.
Jeez.
It is also the highest grossing debut weekend of all time for a horror film. And finally, it is the second highest opening weekend for an R-rated film in box office history, North America, of course.
All these qualifiers, I mean, it's very impressive, but don't keep us in suspense anymore. What's the name of the movie, for Pete's sake?
It is.
It is?
Exactly.
Exactly?
Yes, it is the number one movie in the entire world.
Well, that's what I want to know.
And that's what I just told you.
You said it?
Of course.
You said what?
No. Now you're getting confused about your box office records. What is the name of the highest grossing debut in April?
How should I know?
I just told you.
When?
No. When is the highest grossing debut film of all time in July?
Sometime in July, I assume.
Naturally. What is the highest grossing debut film in April? When is the highest grossing debut in July? It is the highest grossing debut in September and the highest grossing debut weekend of all time? I don't know.
Forget the months, okay? The months are giving me a headache. Just tell me this and give me a straight answer.
Well, there's no need to get personal.
Okay, I get it. Just answer this one question.
Gladly.
You'll tell me what I want to know?
Of course.
Do you know the name of the film with the highest grossing debut weekend of all time?
Yes.
You do?
Naturally. I'd hardly be an entertainment journalist extraordinaire if I couldn't answer a simple question like that.
So what is the highest grossing debut film of all time?
No.
You mean you won't tell me?
I mean you're wrong.
How can I be wrong? I'm asking you a question. What is the name of the film with the highest grossing debut weekend of all time?
No, I told you. What is the highest grossing debut film in April? Pay attention. You want to know the name of the film with the highest grossing debut weekend of all time?
Yes.
You do?
Isn't that why I asked you?
Well, then I'll tell you. The movie with the highest grossing debut weekend of all time? I don't know.
So why did you bring it up?
I thought you'd be interested.
So let me get this straight. What is the highest grossing debut in April? When is the highest grossing debut in July? It is the highest grossing debut in September. And the highest grossing debut of all time? I don't know.
See, Sperling, listening to this podcast has finally started to pay off for you. Should I continue with the rest of the box office?
Please.
Right, okay, of course. So as we've said, It, the Stephen King thriller, is the number one film around the world. $180 million worldwide, set all sorts of records in North America. That despite the fact that about 5% of the market, meaning Florida, was out of the loop. Because, of course, the weather. Nobody, literally nobody in Florida went to a movie. A few people on the border. They literally were reporting on that in Variety and Hollywood Reporter.
And what I would point out is a lot of the theaters in and around the Houston area are still closed as well.
And so, that's the fourth biggest city in North America. It grossed maybe $123 million in North America. You could probably add 5% to that and think it probably would have been close to $130 million. It might have even beaten Deadpool when all is said and done. That, of course, pales in light of the tragedy and people's lives being upended, but that's what Hollywood does. So It is a massive success. That means they will make part two because it's really one long story. So that this film apparently deals with kids fighting Pennywise the clown. And then part two deals with them grown up as adults coming back years later to fight Pennywise one more time. I haven't read the books, didn't see the miniseries, and I haven't seen the film. Did you take your kids to It over the weekend?
I did not. But my question is this. Due to inflation, wouldn't Pennywise be more like Dimewise or Quarterwise?
And number two around the world is Spider-Man Homecoming. $73 million on the weekend, $820 million worldwide. Shay Shay China. That's what Spidey wants to say because it opened in the Middle Kingdom. Why did it do so well? Well, it got great reviews. It's a big name movie with a big property behind it. But it also had the benefit of being the first big Hollywood movie to open up in China after the two-month ban on Hollywood films. During the summer, they have an unofficial blackout and only local movies open up. And frankly, everyone has already seen Wolf Warriors 2 a couple times, and they were chomping at the bit for a new Hollywood movie, and Spider-Man was it. They were ready for it. It was a big movie. It's a pretty good movie. People like it a lot. So it had a big success, and if that keeps up, they could get close to $1 billion. It probably won't happen, but, you know, they're certainly going to look like $900 million, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to know how much, and I know I could do this math on my own, but I would love to know during that blackout time, except for Wolf Warrior 2 this year, which did really well, does the box office each week, does it drop during that blackout period and then come back up once movies from outside the country are let back in? Or not? Does it just kind of stay the same? In other words, people are going to go to the movies no matter what's showing.
Well, they also wait and have big movies ready for that period. We saw a couple other films that did quite well locally. So, you know, when you save your big guns for Thanksgiving or Christmas, you're going to get a lot of box office then. So, you know, it's a combination of saving your big movies for a big period of the year and, of course, less competition from others. At number three around the world is Dunkirk. $15 million on the weekend, $492 million worldwide. So again, that's about to pass the $500 million mark.
And for a $100 million movie, figure another $100 million in marketing around the world, right? That's a profitable movie.
Oh, absolutely. At number four is The Hitman's Bodyguard, $12 million on the weekend, $125 million worldwide. So you do have Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson who are looking for a little bit of extra cash. But again, with a $30 million budget, that's a big success story all around. As is Annabelle Creation, another horror film, $12 million on the weekend. That would be a great opening weekend for that movie, but it's at $280 million worldwide. At number six is Reese Witherspoon back on the screens in Home Again, a light romantic comedy, very light apparently. It opened to just under $10 million in three territories. At number seven is the Tom Cruise film American Made, another $8 million on the weekend. That's at $33 million, and we're still waiting for that to open up in North America, but it is playing in 43 territories. Not the big ones, though. It hasn't opened up in China or Japan or most of the major markets in the UK. Well, perhaps it did that this weekend, but he's a big star everywhere, so he's still got a lot of money to be made. So the story on that movie is not over yet. And number 8 is a new film in South Korea. It's Memoir of a Murderer. It's a thriller about a serial killer with Alzheimer's who has to protect the girl he kidnapped and raised as his own from another killer. It grossed $7 million on the weekend, and it was co-written, co-produced, and directed by stuntman-turned-director Shin Yun Won.
I see an English-language remake.
Yeah, that's an awfully complicated setup. At number 9 is Despicable Me 3. As we said, of course, it has passed the $1 billion mark. Did that over the weekend. Huge success story for, who would that be? Is it Universal?
It would be Illumination Entertainment and Universal, yes.
That's right. And number 10 is The Emoji Movie. Nobody liked it, but it has made money. It's at $170 million worldwide. At a number 11, we have a new film. This is a Japanese animated film. It's called A Silent Voice. And it's about a high school boy who bullies a deaf girl and then falls in love with her, as one will. That opened up in Japan last year, and it won Best Animated Film. And you can also remember Japan had that huge success story with Your Name. This movie made $5 million on the weekend. It's at just about $32 million worldwide. And it's part of a great trend, which is animated films that are not just, you know, superhero or kiddie-oriented films. I love Pixar movies. They're fresh and original, but there's all sorts of types of animated movies you can make, and it's great to see that happening in Japan. At number 12, less interestingly, is Cars 3, which made another $4 million and passed the $350 million mark worldwide. And scrolling down, Wolf Warriors 2 hit $875 million worldwide. Stephen King is not automatic at the box office because The Dark Tower, that's at $107 million worldwide, and they're wondering what they did wrong. Obviously, the answer is they made a not very good movie. And way down at number 23 is a new movie called Federal Police, The Law is for Everyone, which is a rather hopeful title, but it's a Brazilian drama about the biggest anti-corruption sting in the country's history. It opened pretty softly, $2.3 million, but we don't know the budget, so hopefully that'll be a success for all involved.
And in Brazil, that might just be a live feed.
Really?
Because of all the corruption that's going on down there.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they did the story there. Yeah, so it was a big story. And there's one more new movie. It didn't do very well, but it's interesting. It's called Poster Boys, and it's an Indian comedy about three working-class guys who find their pictures on a poster promoting vasectomies. It opened to $1.7 million, and it's a Hindi language remake of a film originally made in the Marathi language. Maharashtra is a territory in Western India. So it was a hit film in Western India under the Marathi language, and now they've decided there was enough of an audience to remake it in the Hindi language for the rest of the country.
I guess dubbing is not an option.
Well, it is an option, but I think in India, there's a lot more subtitling, because I know that when you go see movies, you'll see like three or four subtitles stacked on top of each other. I think there are so many languages that I think it's just easier to do subtitles in each territory.
Yeah, I know that there are certain territories where they actually have laws about how much programming needs to be in a specific language.
That's true. But, you know, there's all sorts of ways to reach people. You could do a live feed in Brazil with a reality as they do another sting operation. We have TV shows playing in the movie theater. And we mentioned that last week when Marvel's Inhumans played in theaters. It looked like it did $2 million. I thought, well, that's pretty good. The reviews were terrible. And in fact, some people say it was a bust.
You mean that the idea was a bust as opposed to it being a bust economically?
Well, that's what I don't quite understand, because to me, they made $2.6 million worldwide. It's not their fault that the show wasn't any good, but they pulled in $2 million, and I thought, well, you know, they brought attention to a TV. They got people to pay to go see two episodes that they'll be able to see for free in about a month on their television. But Jeff Bach of Exhibitor Relations said, this is a pretty ho-hum result. I just don't think the average moviegoer knew what this was, and if they did, certainly didn't know it was debuting in theaters before its TV debut. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, people who are fans of this type of material, this type of content, probably did know. They probably knew going in, this is a Marvel entity, this is a Marvel property, and they knew exactly what they were getting into.
Yeah, they did, and I thought it was a pretty good result. You know, I'm not quite sure why he thought it was a ho-hum result. What did he expect for the first two episodes of a TV show being shown in movie theaters? You know, I thought it was pretty good. But we're talking about Marvel, and that brings up Disney and their streaming service. You know, are you going to go to the movie theater to see it? Then maybe you'll want to own the Blu-ray or DVD, or maybe you just want to watch it on the new Disney app. Isn't that what's happening?
Well, I think that that studios in general are moving away from Blu-ray and DVD.
Well, no, and in fact, here, of course, they want to keep all the money for themselves. They like it when people buy movies on demand because they get more money than if they have to ship a DVD to a store. And further, Disney has said, you know what, we're going to have our own app. Forget Netflix. We don't want your money anymore, Netflix. We're going to keep all our Disney properties on that app. And everybody wanted to know, does that include Marvel and Star Wars? And Disney has announced, Bob Iger said, yep, we're going to keep the Star Wars and Marvel movies for our own streaming service. So you won't find them on Netflix or Hulu or anywhere else. You'll find them on the Disney app.
So those are like the big headliners, if you will. In other words, if you want those movies, you have to subscribe to the Disney Channel, effectively. So they're moving away from Blu-ray and DVD because of the cost of actually making that media. And it will become more expensive over time. But at the same time, Disney is looking for recurring revenue from fans. And they think that they have Star Wars and they have Marvel and they have Pixar and the animated films. These are pieces of content that can have people, you know, people will subscribe effectively to a streaming Disney service year after year after year.
And I don't think they will for Star Wars, because you're talking 8 movies, you know, or I guess 10 movies now, or 9 or 10. So what?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
A TV series, Game of Thrones, is much more valuable. That's 7 seasons, 100 episodes. You can watch all the Star Wars movies in a day. And you say, all right, what do I do Tuesday?
Well, yeah, I think that's more one of those like, okay, I'll subscribe this month and then I'll cancel next month.
Yeah, so, it's not fun. I'm sure Netflix would rather have them. And, of course, Netflix paid Disney about $300 million, I think, last year for all their properties.
Right.
That includes a lot of TV shows and stuff. So that's big coin that Disney's turning down. But Netflix long ago decided, you know what, we want original content. We want to own our own stuff. And TV shows are more valuable to us than movies because there's more of them.
What I'd like to know is, what movies is Disney making beyond Star Wars, beyond Marvel, beyond Pixar, beyond the animated films? Are they making a lot of, well, I guess you could say, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean they're making, right?
Yeah.
But it's not like the days of Touchstone and Hollywood Pictures where they're making a Bette Midler romantic comedy or, a comedy. So beyond that, what movies are they making? So in other words, if I'm not a fan of any of those films, would I subscribe? If I don't like Marvel, if I don't like, Star Wars, if maybe I like dramas, am I going to subscribe to Disney? Probably not.
Well, you know, they've got Mary Poppins, a live action remake of Mary Poppins. They've got A Wrinkle in Time next year, another Indiana Jones movie, Frozen, you know, all the animated films. But yeah, they've obviously got, they've got more than that, but they're not playing the game of Touchstone like they did in the old days. Then they've got some movie with Adam Devine and Jeffrey Tambor called Magic Camp.
Okay, no idea what that is.
You know, it's just a comedy, that a family-friendly comedy. But, you know, Mary Poppins Returns, that'll be a big project. You know, they got stuff going on, but they've got so much money in animation and Marvel that, yeah, they're not making as many sort of, swings at the fences with original one-off movies. But, of course, they should have such problems at Paramount, which just dumped their head and picked Wick Godfrey as a top executive for that studio, which is certainly struggling. Do you know Wick? Are you familiar with him?
Absolutely. I mean, in the 1990s, he was over at 20th Century Fox and Fox Searchlight as an executive working his way up there. He left. He became a producer, produced films like iRobot, which is way back, and many others, and now is back in an executive role at Paramount Pictures. He's basically the head. I mean, realize that they have not had a head for Paramount Pictures in quite some time, which speaks volumes to the fact that they don't have any movies.
Exactly. So that's a fun task, because you know what? They've got nowhere to go but up. As far as I'm concerned, I'd love to have that job.
Yeah, because literally you have to start from what movies have you, what screenplays and properties have you optioned already? Which
and
ones are we keeping?
I beg your pardon. And presumably you step in and say, you're giving me a lot of money, right? Because we got to make some movies here. So we got to greenlight some stuff here. So we got to have some money to play with. So that's going to be fun. And you can always say when things don't go right, it's Rotten Tomatoes' fault.
Well, that's certainly what the New York Times did a story on. And it's certainly what the studios are saying this summer. They're saying, look, you know, the 13.6 million visitors that go to Rotten Tomatoes, which is this movie review aggregation site, that it's causing a dent in the box office and attendance of movies.
But what really bothers them is that when people go online to buy tickets at, say, Fandango, which is like owned by movie studios, isn't it?
Well, wait a second. Warner Brothers did own it outright, and then they sold most of it to Fandango, to NBC Universal Comcast, basically, because NBC Universal Comcast owns Fandango.
Oh, okay. So, but when you go to Fandango to buy a movie, they now display the Rotten Tomatoes price while you're buying the tickets. You're saying, hey, what's a bad movie? Let me find I'm about to buy a ticket to Valerian in the City of, 18.
Ooh, right.
I don't think I want to buy that. And they're like, why are you showing that right there? Are you out of your minds telling people you're an idiot if you buy this ticket? Is that a good business model?
Right. Well, and of course, if you're Fandango and you want to maximize your business and basically, you know, make Rotten Tomatoes more of an influencer and more important, you would do that. You would place it in very valuable, real estate. That's valuable real estate. So
it's just like Amazon posting reviews of products on their site. They're like, there's always something else to buy.
Right, exactly. So that's exactly what Fandango is doing. They're maximizing and trying to increase the value of their company the way they should be doing.
The one complaint I agree with is that there is no weighted system for reviews. A 4-star review and a 2.25-star review, if they're both thumbs up, are essentially the same.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's like, that was that way back with Siskel and Ebert, right? 2 thumbs up. You know, they'd say way up when they really liked a movie, but 2 thumbs up was 2 thumbs up, whether they both thought it was fine or whether they loved it and thought it was the best film of the year.
Well, and Brooks Barnes, who wrote this story, points out that in the late 1920s, when the star rating system came out, you know, 4 stars, 3 stars, you know, people thought, oh my gosh, it's a reductionist, you know, it got to be more nuanced than that. That people felt like, well, you know, it's just a quick and easy way to know whether the movie's good. And that's exactly what's happening here. The problem that you have is Rotten Tomatoes is now working with 3,000 critics, apparently. I don't necessarily think it's 3,000 critics. I know critics that are on there that haven't published a review in more than a decade. Okay, but
well, they say you have to have active reviewing, and when they put you on, you have to be at a site publishing for like 18 months or a year or something like that. They have all sorts of criteria, but you know, it's kind of like, even if they're people you never heard of, you're sort of crowdsourcing the reviews. It's like when a book has 1,000 reviews, you can start to get a better sense of, okay, this actual consensus seems fairly reasonable because a lot of people have weighed in. When there's only 10 critics, you know, you can easily make a movie have a great review or a terrible review. When you got 1,000, it's harder to throw it off with 1 or 2 bad reviews or good reviews. So that's not a problem to me. But again, I wish they would weight their reviews a little more than just yes or no.
Yeah, and I didn't realize this. Certainly back in the 90s, you could get on to Rotten Tomatoes very easily. They needed critics. And so online critics I can't tell you the number of online critics I put onto Rotten Tomatoes when I was at Film Stew, at least 10. And these are people that, yes, some of them are still reviewing and they're very well-known critics now, but at the time weren't well-known at all. And yet their reviews were weighted along with Kenneth Turan's and A.O. Scott's and Manola Darkness.
They also have a top critics section, right? You can refine it so it shows top critics. And personally, I use it just to go to the reviews. I don't look at the number as much. I say, all right, I'm looking at this movie. There's 10 or 15 reviews of people I recognize, and I can quickly link to the actual review and read it. I find that useful. And you glance at the top list. You know what? For all my bitching, Logan Lucky, Dunkirk, Spider-Man, those are all 90% or above, and those all are pretty well-reviewed movies, you know?
Well, and I found it interesting that what Mr. Barnes from the New York Times has found out here is that the publicity departments are actually finding that they can invite certain critics to early reviews to try and influence the latecomers. So they know, like, oh, if Manola Dargis or A.O. Scott or Kenneth Turan or Justin Chang from the L.A. Times, if those critics, being top critics,
hate a particular director, they're like, don't invite them early.
Right. And so they'll invite the critics that they think have a better shot at giving a good review and who will influence the later critics who are like, oh, me too. I like that movie too.
Right. So they took it to a horror film festival and let all the people who are crazy about horror flicks review it first. And of course they loved it. And that established a beachhead. Now, certainly no top critic said, some guy from screamingbloodymurder.com liked it, so I better like it too. That's not happening. I think that's just a little BS. But you know, it's nice to have that early establishment of, oh, the horror geeks liked it.
Right. And then there's also the whole like, oh, there's a review embargo until 2 minutes before the movie opens so that all the advance ticket sales have been done. And then maybe you lose, you know, Sunday sales because people who waited that long are waiting to see what the reviews are. But like the Emoji Movie, I think the delay was 4 hours, you know, the
well, they've been doing that a long time, long before Rotten Tomatoes existed. You know, they got a bad movie. They don't show it to critics.
Right. Oh, so yeah. No. And it was like, you know, the day of or not at all. And now they're showing it to critics and saying there's an embargo. You can't publish until like literally the first showing is over in New York.
Well, I haven't heard that.
Yeah. And there's actually somebody.
True? Because I'm not sure that's right. I mean, I know that they just simply don't show it. But like you can't give it to the Times and say you can't run the review till after the movie's opened. Oh, I don't think they would be willing to do that.
They actually do, the studios have been doing that, and there was somebody, I want to say it was on TechCrunch, that tried to do a mathematical algorithm for how well the movie would open based on the time span of the embargo between when the embargo was lifted and when the first showing of the film was. And it was some big mathematical equation, and, you know, like, the Emoji Movie was only 4 hours, so it was going to do incredibly poorly, whereas, like, Dunkirk was 2 weeks, so it was, you know, it was going to open huge because of that. And, you know...
I'm getting confused. I'm just saying, you're telling me the New York Times will agree to see a movie and promise not to run the review till after it's opened?
Oh,
they're not going to post it the night before, at midnight or something? Really?
I think that those movies, they don't even bother. I think...
Right. They just don't let the top critics go. Right. Maybe some schmuck they can push around and say, you can't, you know, you have to wait till the movie's open, which is ridiculous. But Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, the major critics with actual thing, they're not going to agree to that. They will agree not to, you know, publish a review 3 weeks in advance, but they're not going to say, we have to wait till the movie opens. That's absurd.
Yeah, I think it's now the embargo lifts. Like for the Emoji Movie, it was 4 hours. So,
but then, but again, they weren't inviting the Times to that. They're not going to, the Times is not going to see a movie and say, we will wait till after it opens to run a review. If they do, they should not do that. That's bad.
Well, the Emoji Movie was published Thursday, like literally at midnight. So,
but it opens on Thursday. So you're telling me they had to wait till after the movie opened because most movies open Thursday at like 7 p.m.
Yeah. And that seems to be what happened here.
For the New York Times.
For the New York Times. And it was given to Glenn Kenny.
The timestamp is difficult because they can sometimes update it.
Right. And that's true.
You know, the timestamp's a little confusing. I would assume that they would insist that they be able to run it Wednesday night at midnight online and have it in the paper on Friday. But if they're doing something else, I'd love to know. So if you know the inside story on this, are big critics and big outlets capitulating to the studios and refusing to, you know, holding stuff until later, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Our page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. But, you know, Michael, I do wonder... if at some point, I mean, Rotten Tomatoes has been around for what, 19 years, and it's grown, right?
Yeah.
But I do wonder if at some point, whether it's, you know, Metacritic, Rotten Tomatoes, whether anybody will do a study on this.
Or they'll get the inside scoop of what it was like to work at Rotten Tomatoes when they began to topple Hollywood, right? We'll get the insider scoop on it. Maybe they'll even, I don't know, write a book.
Oh, wait a second. If they're going to write a book, then it must be time for Book Filter. Now, Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week, Michael, you pick a few books to bring here from all of the books that are published and that you guys rate and review over there. You pick a few that maybe Hollywood should be paying attention to, or filmmakers and producers should be paying attention to for adaptation to television shows or movies. What have you got for us this week?
Well, like I said before, like you mentioned before, it's a cookbook this week. I mean, before I get there, I love mystery, so I considered picking The Bloody Black Flag. It's the first book in a new mystery series, and it's set on a pirate ship. You've got pirates and a murder mystery. So it's a great mashup of two genres. There's a pirate running around on the ship trying to figure out who killed his best friend before they kill him. And then there's a memoir, a nonfiction book called Ranger Games, and it's about a writer investigating his younger cousin and trying to figure out how that kid went from a newly minted U.S. Army Ranger about to be deployed for the first time to Iraq. And on his final weekend of leave, he and his buddies from the Rangers went out and knocked over a bank and ended up in jail for absolutely no good reason. Everyone around him was like, what happened and why and how did this happen? And he's written a book called Ranger Games about that. And it's getting great reviews. I'm really looking forward to reading it.
And it's a nonfiction book, it sounds like.
It's a nonfiction book, yeah. It sounds really interesting. I'm really chomping at the bit to read that one. But my pick this week is Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. It's a new cookbook from Christopher Kimball. Do you recognize the name?
Not only do I recognize the name, Michael, but here's what I love about this selection. I have actually pre-ordered this book because I get Milk Street, the magazine. Of course, Christopher Kimball is from America's Test Kitchen. He founded that and Cooks Illustrated. He founded both of those. The magazine was Cooks Illustrated. And I used to get Cooks Illustrated and I used to watch the show. And now I get the Milk Street, the new magazine, and I ordered the cookbook.
Did you go to Bookfilter and use the link to go to Amazon? No, you did not.
No, because you know what? I had to do it through Milk Street. They gave me a little like, hey, pre-order
Bastards.
Now and for
Bastards.
Subscribers.
Bastards. All right. Well, so yeah, people who don't know, he's part of this empire, this multimedia empire, magazines, TV show, cookbook called America's Test Kitchen, a huge success story. He's only 66 years old, but the people in charge of that company finally decided, you know what, he's getting a little old. We want to look at towards the future, and they shoved him aside. They wanted him to take an emeritus role and just sort of dodder around and let the younger kids take over. And he was having none of that. And he went off and he launched an entirely new empire with a new philosophy, sort of. And he's determined to prove them wrong and, you know, and get revenge. So it's a juicy revenge story. And Kimball wants to prove that revenge is indeed a dish best served warm, straight from the oven, with apparently a nice glass of fresh milk on the side.
Yes, you know, you're right. That really is the story here. It's more of a business story where he really did, you know, was ageism at its best here, or worst, depending on how you look at it, because I think a lot of people were a little surprised that he left Cooks Illustrated.
Well, he was kicked out.
Right. Well,
basically.
Precisely.
Yeah. So are you happy with New Milk Street? Do you like the magazine? Is there something fresh and different about it, or is it just the same stuff with a new packaging, which would be fine? It was very successful.
It's a little bit broader in its scope of, you know, the types of dishes it tackles. It's not just, you know, mostly American dishes. So it wanders afar a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Well, yeah. So that's a great backstory. I'm interested in the cookbook and the story. I imagine a documentary or a feature film could happen in a heartbeat. And if it, you know, it's a book that I haven't picked up yet, but you know, I get thousands of books sent to me all the time, but once in a while, for whatever reason, a book slips through the crack and I want to buy a physical copy for some reason. And I actually go into a bookstore and I did it again and I feel like an idiot.
Why is that?
Because I went to buy Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, his memoir. He's coming to Broadway, as we've discussed. And I knew I wanted to read the book. Somehow Simon & Schuster had it on such an embargo, I never got a copy of it. And I knew I wanted to share with my friend Noam, who might be going to the show. He's a big fan. So I wanted a physical copy, not an ebook. And I went to the library and, you know, the ebook, the line to get onto that was too long. I was tired of waiting. So, all right, it's coming out in paperback. I'll just buy that. I go to Barnes and Noble. I pick up the paperback the day it comes out after going to a used bookstore and seeing if there was a used copy of the hardcover, but there wasn't. So I'm at Barnes and Noble. I pick up the book, go to the register, $22.
Oh my God.
$22. And I'm like, what? It's not on sale? You know, like it's bestseller in the hardcover. It's going to be a bestseller in paperback. But no, it wasn't on sale yet if it's going to be. And of course, I'm at the store. If you go to barnesandnoble.com, I could buy that paperback for $14 or the ebook for $13. And I feel like an idiot, but I wanted to share the book and I didn't want to wait anymore. So I just bought it. But you know, you go to the store and they make you feel like a schmuck for being there and buying the book. That's really not a good thing. And then 2 days later, I was in Costco and they've only got like 20 books on a big table. But damn it, one of them was Bruce Springsteen and it was $12 in trade paperback. I was like, son of a bitch. So that may be one reason why Barnes & Noble sales fell more than 6% in the second quarter. They fell 6.6% compared to 1 year earlier. But book sales fell only 2.8%. So they're falling, but not as fast. The problem was that non-book sales, stuff like coloring books, which was supposed to be their hot category for years to come, that fell 8%. Sales at barnesandnoble.com, their website, those also fell. So did sales in the Nook division. They fell 25%. That's their e-reader and their ebook area. They fell to $30 million. Who did they blame? They said, well, a year ago we had Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and that sold, you know, 4.5 million copies, you know, in North America. So, you know, we couldn't match that hit.
It couldn't be the fact that they've actually, like, abandoned the Nook and nobody even knows what it is anymore.
Right. This is for sales overall. They blamed it. So, yeah. So they've lost not as much money as last year, but only because they're slashing expenses at Nook and abandoning the e-reader. So their latest plan, you know, they've had, we're going to have beer, we're going to have a bigger cafe area. Their new plan is to open some new stores.
Yeah, this I don't get at all. I mean, I do get it, but I also think, who is the CEO here? Because they're trying to basically get out of leases. And at each year, 130 stores, they have what, 600 and some odd stores?
Yeah.
Still. And each year, 130 stores are up for, you know, rent renewal, and the leases are up. And so what they're trying to do is downsize some of these stores because they've probably closed some in markets where they really want to be in, but they don't want to be in that store anymore because that store is really expensive and they're an anchor tenant. And because of that, they, you know, get charged a lot of rent. So they want to downsize their stores and maybe pay less rent.
Right. They were known for their mega stores. That's where they made their bones, these huge mega stores. And they now want a smaller footprint. So they're like, well, we're going to let that lease lapse and move into a smaller space where we'll still have a lot of books, but we won't be paying four floors of retail space so that you all can come in and read a magazine and drink a coffee.
Right. Pretty much.
So, you know, they're right to downsize. They're right to do that. I'm sure they're in some markets that they want to be in a smaller space. Other markets they abandon, they want to get back in. But, you know, it's a tough road to hoe, no doubt about it. And then you go into the store and you feel like a schmuck.
Well, if they can actually make it, if they're still around 4 years from now, it would be, yeah, I'd be surprised.
Oh, it would be a huge thing. It would be a gigantic, it would be big.
Oh, well, if that would be big, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, forget Game of Thrones.
Hollywood, never.
Hollywood is fighting a battle royale, not for a throne, but for a franchise. To be specific, they want the distribution rights to Bond. James Bond. Yes, Sony's deal is over, and MGM and the producers are accepting offers. Warner Brothers has the inside track, but it's not the only entity bidding. Apple and Amazon would also like to distribute a James Bond film, and they're instant worldwide reach and cross-promotion capability make them interesting partners. But just as the throne in the HBO series is awfully uncomfortable, it's made out of swords after all. Winning James Bond isn't exactly a thrilling prize either. MGM and the producers cut such a tough deal that some outside estimates said Sony may have actually, get this, lost money distributing the last Bond film, Spectre, even though it grossed $880 million worldwide. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a really good point. It's like, why do you want it? But this isn't just about distributing the movie. It's also about the Bond universe. A sickening term, of course. They've been really smart about doling out these movies every 2 years, every 3 years, and now a few more years in between. It used to be every 2 years you'd get a new Bond film, right? And that's made it arguably the most successful franchise of all time. I mean, it's going on for 50 years now. However, there's lots of Bond that hasn't happened. There's no James Bond on TV. There are no spinoffs. There's no young James Bond TV series or movie series. And I think the play from Apple and Amazon is, hey, you know what? We could get in the Bond world and want to wait every 3 years for these big movies, but there's other stuff that we could do.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting possibility. I mean, that's what they want to do. I think, you know what? You've done a great job of protecting this franchise and making it special by keeping it as a movie. But, you know, I don't know.
I think for Amazon, it's, you know, Q, what do you have for me? Well, I don't know. Let's see what I can pick up on Amazon.com. No. Or for Apple, it's, I don't know. Let's see what my iPhone will do. Here's a souped up iPhone. It's the iPhone 12. And look, it's got smoke screen.
But MGM's busy. They're also reviving Orion with John Hegeman. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, he worked at Blumhouse, New Regency. He was involved with Tyler Perry, The Blair Witch Project, 28 Weeks Later, a lot of Eli Roth horror flicks. Now he's coming to MGM to revive Orion. And if you're like me, I'm old enough to remember the heyday of Orion in the 80s when they kept winning Best Picture Oscars and made one great movie after another. At one point, that was a hell of a brand. I mean, Orion really was a stamp of quality. So I am assuming it's not going to be a horror flick label.
No, and I remember they were winning, in 1992, 91, they were winning Best Picture for Silence of the Lambs and going out of business at the same time. It was like a funeral at the Oscars that year.
It was very sad.
Okay, are you ready for some football, Michael? And I mean American football. Apparently, not so much. The ratings are in for the NFL season kickoff in North America, and American football is losing ground. For the second year in a row, the audience for the first games ticked downward. That's never a good sign, but don't cry for the league just yet. Sunday Night Football is sure to be the most popular show in the U.S. again this year. Three of the top five shows on broadcast TV were football, and it also dominates basic cable in the ratings. Apparently, the endless stories of concussions and health issues and the like haven't dampened enthusiasm that much. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I was trying to see if there's a distinction between college football, whether people are watching college football more, and I haven't been able to quite figure that out yet. I've got some numbers, but I can't compare them easily to last year. So it might be that people are flocking more to college football. There's still a lot of football there. Three of the top five shows on TV, of course, are football. They're all over the place. So, yeah, they're not going away anytime soon. But, you know, for people like me who don't like the violence, we want to fight against it. And we say that we will not stop until people stop watching these violent programs. We shall overcome.
Whoa, Michael, stop that. You know, we can't afford to pay for the rights to that classic protest song. You know, filmmakers sometimes have to pay six figures to put it in their features and documentaries. But actually, you know what? This just in, now we can afford to sing it because the song, or at least the familiar first verse and chorus, have been ruled by a judge to be in the public domain. We Shall Overcome was a folk tune from the 1800s. Singer Pete Seeger famously put it into copyright not to profit from the song, but to prevent others from copywriting it and profiting or controlling it unduly. Now a judge has ruled that the most famous portions of the song are in the public domain, thanks to a lawsuit begun by the lawyers who freed Happy Birthday from copyright as well. Further, it's possible that the song would have always been in the public domain, and that people are potentially up for a refund.
Yikes.
Changing We Will Overcome, by the way, to We Shall Overcome and other minor tweaks to the melody were not substantial enough to merit copyright in the first place. The decision will come later on that. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, there's a big mess in copyright, and things like this kind of drive you nuts. But like Happy Birthday is still in the public domain. We Shall Overcome is it's an interesting case. I don't think it has a lot of wide implications other than the broad movement to say, hey, you know what? We need to start chipping away at all this stuff and start to set some precedent so that stuff is in the public domain when it should be, rather than assuming it's not. But it's funny. I mentioned that it was a folk tune in the notes there. I didn't know. You can see it referred to as a Negro spiritual and then an African-American spiritual. And now we're like, well, there's no reason to, it's a folk tune. So, you know, you sort of how you refer to songs and artists changes over the decades. And that was a good example right there.
The news gets worse for 21st Century Fox, which has been trying to clean house at Fox News. So its takeover of the UK satellite service Sky can go through. Instead, Conservative leader Theresa May and her government have called for an in-depth review and full investigation of the takeover before it can move forward, which is a major snag in what Fox hoped would be clear sailing. Instead of just deciding whether the $15 billion takeover would give Fox too much market share of news, they're going to look into whether the Murdochs are fit and proper owners. For example, Culture Minister Karen Bradley addressed concerns about the alleged Foxification of Fox-owned news outlets. I consider it important, she said, that entities which adopt controversial or partisan approaches to news and current affairs in other jurisdictions should, at the same time, have a genuine commitment to broadcasting standards here. That's what she said. Is this a big deal or big whoop?
They're like, that's our business model, sweetheart. What are you talking about?
Yeah, come on.
And I say sweetheart because the problems exist again with sexual harassment. They fired Eric Bolling. They cleared Charles Payne and decided he was fine and brought him back to Fox Business News. And they've reshuffled their prime time with Laura Ingraham going to 10, Sean Hannity going to 9, and the 5, who used to be on at 5 p.m., now they're at 9 p.m., well, they're going back to 5 o'clock. I mean, I want a list of all the male hosts at Fox News who weren't sexually harassing women, and you can start with Shep Smith.
Now, since we're talking about media news, the New York tabloids once dominated media with their scoops and their headlines. Now they're just losing money and hoping to get a front page headline retweeted a bunch of times. So it's no surprise that the New York Daily News has been sold. It was snapped up by Trunk, the chain that also owns, among others, the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, giving them newspapers in the three biggest markets in the country and an ability to offer one-stop shopping for those who want national advertising. They'll also save money by making use of the Daily News printing press for smaller papers. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, I guess. Someone still sees value in newspapers, and they've said, you know what, if we have a chain across the country and can have enough big markets, maybe we can offer national advertising and make it work that way. It's quicker and easier, and maybe people find value in it. I assume they're also going to cross-promote online with print. So, you know, thank goodness somebody sees newspapers as a viable business down the road.
It's the end of an era. One of the last remaining celebrity editors of a magazine, someone who is famous just for being a magazine editor, is retiring. Yes, Graydon Carter of Vanity Fair is stepping down after a 25-year run. I remember when he first got that job. And he's doing it, by the way, pretty much on top. That leaves perhaps Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone as the last one standing, assuming Tina Brown, who used to run Vanity Fair and The New Yorker, doesn't jump back in. And of course, we're probably forgetting some major player in fashion mags, because what do we know about fashion? Have you seen how Michael and I dress? It's embarrassing. Anna Winter. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? He's been there a long time. Now he's retiring. Famous person retires with lots of money.
Well, it's...
And hello, Karen Woodward.
Yeah.
As a callback.
Yeah, a callback from one of our former hosts who would say, yeah, man loses job. But here is where I think it might be a big deal is that, you know, he really was a royal watcher, and the number of times the UK royals were on the front cover of those magazines was pretty astonishing.
Vanity Fair?
Of Vanity Fair, yes.
Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
And he was, instrumental in kind of upping the celebrity cachet of Vanity Fair over the years. It already had, you know, a lot, but he did a good job over the years. I will say that.
Sure.
Now, give me a hit, Michael. That's what everyone wants, from a major TV network to cable channels to streaming services and even platforms like Facebook and apps like Twitter. But Jeff Bezos at Amazon really means it. He really wants a hit. A wave of cancellations caught people by surprise. The drama Z was renewed for season 2 until it wasn't. The Last Tycoon was dumped, and so on. The reason? If a show isn't a globe-trotting and globe-spanning phenomenon, Amazon isn't interested. After early success with the dramedy Transparent, in fact it won the Emmy, they've struggled on the TV side to catch fire, or even halt and catch fire. Get it? They want big shows, Game of Thrones-type big shows, because, you know, who doesn't? One new show on tap? Get this, Tong Wars. A period drama about Chinese immigrants in the U.S. that features Paul Attanasio as a creator and director. Wong Kar-wai will be directing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I guess. They want a hit, right? And they're like, give us a hit. I'm interested in Tong Wars, I guess, and they name some other big properties. But Wong Kar-wai is not exactly the person I think of when I think of big, flashy, you know, type TV stuff, commercial properties. So I know he's a big name. I love his films. That's not the first guy I would turn to if I want a big, fat, worldwide commercial hit.
Yeah,
I could be wrong. I'm assuming it won't have a glacial pace and look gorgeous. And I love his movies. I mean, don't get me wrong, but really? Wong Kar-wai? Okay. You know, Spielberg, sure, he's got commercial instincts, but Wong Kar-wai is an artist. Do they know that?
Paul Attanasio, by the way, I made a mistake there. He's the creator and writer, so he's basically like the showrunner, not the director.
Yeah.
Now, last week, Michael and I pled ignorance when it came to some of the songs that were big hits this summer. Who exactly is Lil Uzi Vert? Sounds like a French pastry to me. I don't know. And where's a 12-year-old to answer that question when you need them? Turns out we should have been hanging out on SoundCloud. That's where rappers like Lil Uzi and I don't even know how to pronounce this, Michael. Xtemptation? Is that?
Xtemptation, I think.
Yeah. Have been making names for themselves. That's to a huge fan base. Their albums made a splash on Billboard with Lil Uzi debuting at number one. That's a lot of streaming. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you know, you got to stay on top of this stuff. It's a big whoop. SoundCloud is proving itself as a good platform that can work for them. You've got last week they were number one and number two. This week, Lil Uzi Vert and Xtemptation are at number two and number three because LCD Sound System is in there at number one. But you know, you want to be cool with the kids. You want to know what's happening in rap. You gotta keep reading. I mean, Kodak Black is at number seven. Have you been reading him? He's from Pompano Beach, Florida. So I hope he and his family are safe. That's for sure.
You mean listening? You mean listening, not reading.
Oh, did I say reading?
Yes.
Ah, well, you know, I'm reading, I guess. So yeah, they're in Florida. So I hope they're all safe and fine. And I know a lot of friends of flooding in Fort Lauderdale and Pompano where I grew up. So, you know, Kodak Black is famous for legal problems and Instagram stuff. So he used Instagram to sort of get his fame going. So all these platforms, they can pay off.
Hey, maybe Facebook has the right idea then. Its push to get people to use their platform for watching video has an early modest success story. It's a prank show from A&E called Bay or Bail. In it, couples discover how loyal they are when tossed into wacky, unpredictable, and entirely unexpected situations. If a tiger walks into the room, do you leap in front of your spouse to offer protection or shove past them to reach the door first? That sort of thing.
What was that movie with the landslide, the avalanche?
Oh,
the French film.
Force Majeure.
Force Majeure, yeah, yeah. I really thought of that, yeah.
Well, the videos have reached 24 million views already, which Taylor Swift says, ha, pshaw, with hundreds of thousands of shares and more than 35,000 comments. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, they're showing a little traction. You know, it's not a knock out of the park success story yet, but that's what they wanted to work.
Okay, now this next story is pretty awesome. The guys behind South Park oversaw a video game a few years ago that was critically acclaimed and a huge bestseller. So they're players in the video game world, okay, the South Park guys. Now they're launching a new video game called South Park, The Fractured But Whole. And here's the twist. The higher the difficulty level of the game that you want to play, the darker your skin color becomes. If you want to play at the super easy beginner's level, you'll be as white can be. The more difficult the game challenges become, the darker your skin gets until even Isaac Hayes would give you props. Among the changes are how much in-game money you receive and how other characters treat you. To make sure the social commentary isn't lost on anyone, a main character will say to players, "Don't worry, this doesn't affect combat, just every other aspect of your whole life." Big deal or big whoop?
What's a big deal? You know, I mean, these things you think, oh, who cares? It doesn't matter. It matters. You know, when you see characters portrayed positively, like gay and lesbian and transgender and people of color in multiple roles in all sorts of media, that affects you. That has an impact. And something like this, that's extremely clever and smart and interesting to get you to think about white privilege or, you know, whoa, shut up, you know, and think about how your life is affected on a daily basis. It's very funny and very smart. And video games are cool. You know, there's a lot of good writing going there. The Nebula Awards, they're one of the top awards for science fiction and fantasy writing. They've just added a category to their annual ceremony for best game writing in the video game world because there are a lot of writing going on there and some of it's really clever and good.
Now, do you love theater, Michael? I think you do.
I do.
Yeah, you're not alone. Season subscriptions for live theater around the U.S. have hit a record high, and it's not just the Hamilton effect, okay? Subscriptions have been rising for 5 years in a row now, though, yeah, you know, Hamilton doesn't hurt, since if it's coming to town and you want an easy ticket, you'll have to buy the entire 4 or 5 show package in a lot of cases. Broadway Across America is the producer in charge of bringing Broadway shows to some 44 markets, and they announced more than 400,000 season subscribers. Okay, to put it in perspective, that's better than the NBA, which has about 300,000 subscribers. Of course, NBA teams have about 40 home games in a season, but on the other hand, LeBron James can't hit a high C nearly as well as he hits three-pointers. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big whoop. I'm not sure if this covers everybody. I think there are other touring people, but it's good news for the theater world. And there's been lots of steady hits, so it makes sense. And there's a lot of theater news coming out. I mean, Hello Dolly last week dropped $1.2 million from like over $2 million to $900,000 in a week.
Wow.
Because Bette Midler was out and Donna Murphy was her substitute. She's been doing Tuesday nights. She got great reviews when they reviewed her. I wish I could see her. But people are like, they want to see Bette. So the big question is, who are they going to replace her with? And the answer is Bernadette Peters. She and Victor Garber are going to step into the lead roles, replacing Bette Midler and David Hyde Pierce when they walk away. Bernadette Peters is one of the biggest stars in Broadway history. She's an amazing talent, and she has a long track record of being shoved into shows that she's not appropriate for. She won the Tony for Annie Get Your Gun, but she is nobody's idea of a rough and tumble country gal. She is city to her core. Hello, Dolly. This is not a natural fit for her. I hope she pulls it off, but you just go, oof, I really wanted to see Queen Latifah or a number of other people. Bernadette Peters does not make sense to me, but she's a pro. She'll be good. She'll sing the hell out of it. And Victor Garber's great. But again, poor Bernadette Peters being put into a show that she doesn't quite work on.
You know what doesn't make sense to me? Mean Girls is a Broadway musical.
Why not?
I don't
Young
know,
girls
I just
make up 60% of Broadway's audience, and they love that movie. So yeah, Tina Fey's bringing Mean Girls to Broadway next spring. She's writing the book. Angels in America is coming to Broadway. That's a new revival with Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield, the one-time Spider-Man, though nobody's going to remember that very soon. That's coming over from London where it was at. I'm interested in seeing that. And Hamilton. Hamilton's going to London. So they bring Angels in America here. We can send Hamilton over there. And they, unfortunately, had to delay the opening of the first preview, I should say, for like a week or 10 days or something because of construction, you know, the revamping of the house. Sometimes it doesn't go smoothly. And it's a shame because, you know, people buy their tickets way in advance. It's such a hot ticket. They plan to travel from all over to be there early on. You know, nobody likes to do a delay like that, but you know, it's obviously unavoidable or they wouldn't do it.
You know, I know people, you know, when Celine Dion was doing that residency, She would cancel all the time, and it just, you know, and it would happen to the same people like 2-3 times.
I didn't know that she had a long track record of canceling. She's pretty, I don't know of her having, I mean, obviously it happened to them, but I don't know her having a long running problem with, you know, appearances. It was, I'd have to look that up, but
it was only during a residency. It wasn't, you know, it isn't on tour.
It was when she was in Vegas.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But she was there for like 2 years or whatever. Yeah. And I saw her there, but of course that was it wasn't even a press preview. I just saw her there on my own with my mom. I was there for a wedding, but, I don't know her to have a history of that. Donna Murphy, who's in Hello Dolly, she did have problems with that in a number of shows where she was a problem or a no-show. So yeah, that can be an issue. But Celine Dion, that's too bad.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, we really can't afford that music. Okay, that one's not in the public domain. Okay.
Don Williams just said, ka-ching.
Yeah, exactly. Not from us. I can tell you that. So here's how this will affect you.
MGMT just got on the phone with me. They're just calling me, texting me. I wonder why that is. Anyway, keep going.
don't answer. So here's the deal. They're making all these Star Wars movies, right? And the Han Solo movie, they fire the directors. Now, the Star Wars Episode 9, they are changing directors, right? Who was the guy that Colin Trevorrow?
Colin Trevorrow, and now they've dumped him, and they've just announced J.J. Abrams will take over Star Wars Episode 9.
Right, and Josh Trank, Fantastic Four, after that movie tanked, they dumped him.
Even before, they dumped him when they had problems on the set, and they decided they did not want to work with him. And in fact, even on the
Rogue
what movie
One?
Was that?
Rogue One.
Yeah, Tony Gilroy kind of took over for Gareth Edwards.
And he did it with, by the way, they did it. They did that with blessing. So Gareth Edwards was like, yeah, this is like way more than I can handle, Tony. If you can come in and help, that would be great.
Well, that's what they said publicly. I'd like to hear that from Gareth Edwards myself. But yeah, so massive reshoots on Rogue One. You know, they've dumped two directors now. The only movie that went totally smoothly was the one with J.J. Abrams. And that did gross $2 billion worldwide. So the question is the problem Marvel and Disney and their working relationship with directors? Or is it just, hey, this is the way the business runs these days?
Well, I think when you look at J.J. Abrams and even Ron Howard, these are directors that you really can't push around, okay? There's not really much you can do to them. J.J. Abrams, he doesn't need to be doing this, okay? They had to beg him to do the, you know, episode, you know, 7.
Well, they didn't beg him to do that, they when he agreed to do it, they would have loved to have him do episode 8 and 9, but he just said, no, thank you.
Right, and so now he's back for 9. And the reality is, you know, when you've got a Gareth Edwards or a Josh Trank or a Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, you can, you know, they're at the beginning stages of their career. They're not a Christopher Nolan where you can't really say Christopher Nolan wants to release movies on 70mm. He's going to get to release movies on 70mm. That's
but clearly you can't push them around because they were like, no, we want to do it this way. And they had to fire them. So someone you can push around or work with is someone that will do what you tell them.
Well, yeah, I guess ultimately, I don't necessarily know whether it was that they were unhappy with. In other words, I don't necessarily know that even if those directors listened, okay, that they would have been kept on. That's what I'm
trying
to say.
Here's a couple of possibilities. One, they thought the work was bad and it was going to hurt the franchise.
Right.
Or two, they think these franchises are too valuable and we want to play it safe. And so, yeah, we brought in creative, interesting people, and they made a great movie. We're not interested in a great movie. We want a movie that we know is going to work commercially and keep us, asleep at night. Or three, the sexist idea is that Kathleen Kennedy is too difficult to work with.
Well, I mean, certainly she, you know, is known as a tough producer and was before this, you know, she ever got to Lucasfilm.
Like Scott Rudin and a million other producers.
I was just going to say the same thing. You know, that's how she's able to produce these movies, by the way. Yeah. And same thing for Scott Rudin. Not every producer is nice. That's just the way it is.
Suddenly a 30-year track record and she's the problem.
Right. And so, look, she's produced some of the biggest hits around. You don't do that by, you know, being everybody's best friend. So now she's the head of Lucasfilm. She's over at Disney and she's overseeing this monolithic, all these films, this entire franchise, this entire universe. And you know what? It's a big job. I don't necessarily know that I would want that job.
And the two movies she's released, she would say, hey, by the way, Star Wars Episode 7 made $2 billion, and Rogue One made over $1 billion. So the movies that are coming out, people are happy with.
Well, I think, yes, I think looking back on it, a lot of people said, hey, Episode 7, you just kind of remade the first movie.
Oh, I'm not talking creatively. I'm talking commercially.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No,
creatively has nothing to do with it. We're talking about business here.
Well, okay, then, yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. They got J.J. Abrams in, that the movie will move forward. Colin Trevorrow, who was on Star Wars Episode 9, he's directed 2 Jurassic Parks now. So
yeah, and they couldn't work with him.
Right,
that's where you raise your eyebrow. As Lady Bracknell said in The Importance of Being Earnest to Ernest, who was an orphan, she said, "To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness."
Right, exactly.
So, you know, all right, you couldn't work with the guys from Lego Movie who had a big hit. Now you can't work with a guy who's delivered Jurassic Park working alongside Spielberg. That starts to get a little iffy. And now you may have trouble recruiting people in the future. But maybe you don't want these bold, aggressive young people. Maybe you want people like Ron Howard, who you trust and feel safe with and will deliver the product that you want.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, agents will start shying their talent away from this. You know, depending on where they are in their career, they might say, hey, you know what? It'll be a great little bump initially, but then when you get fired off the film, it's not going to look good on your resume.
Yeah.
But you know who's not being fired off a film is Patty Jenkins. Of course, she did the Wonder Woman over the summer. She directed that and did a fine job by everybody's account. And now she will be doing the sequel.
That's right. Warner Brothers said, where should we park the truck of money?
Correct. Well, and you know what? She actually did a good job, not only of directing the film, obviously, but she delivered on time, on budget, and then really did a great job on the promotional circuit, doing all the publicity, doing all the interviews. And, you know, she was...
That's part of the job.
Right. Well, not every director can do that well. And she did.
No. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were very happy and they were going to move heaven and earth to make sure she did the sequel.
And she
I'm sure Disney tried the same thing with J.J. Abrams. And they're like, thank God he's coming back for part 9.
That's true. But that ends Inside Baseball for this week and moves us along into our obituary section.
That's right. A couple people died in the last week, of course. There's many more, but a couple that we can speak to. One is Michael Friedman. He's a lyricist and a creative talent who worked with the Civilians, which is a terrific troupe here in New York that does really cool stuff with found text, or they interview people and create shows out of that. They're a really cool company. And he also worked on Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which made it all the way to Broadway. He died from complications of AIDS, which that felt like a flashback to me. You know what? AIDS is still here. There are lots of drugs to deal with it. If you have enough money and can afford it, they can be toxic. But yeah, you can live with AIDS, but people still do die from AIDS as well. And there's rising rates in communities of color and of course, drug users. So AIDS is still a really bad, scary issue. And seeing that was sort of like, wow, took you back to the 80s when every week you'd see people dying from AIDS. And it was such a nightmare.
He was only 41 years old.
Yeah, so that's very sad. And, you know, one little mistake, you know, you can, well, what did he do? In the old days, we'd say, what did he do wrong? And now we're like, oh, gosh, you know, something, it's an illness. It's a disease. You caught a disease, you know, so it's a very sad and tragic and quite a loss. Don Ohlmeyer, on the other hand, was an NBC exec, and he worked at a lot of networks. He died at 72. Long career in television. Monday Night Football was certainly one of his big claims to fame. He worked on Monday Night Football for many years, oversaw Special Bulletin, which was a great TV movie that was kind of a really cool, groundbreaking one, did a lot of other stuff. And then finally, there's a real legend. Sir Peter Hall died in the UK. He was a theatrical director, and he did everything. He founded the Royal Shakespeare Company at the age of 29. He ran the National Theatre, which is just an institution in the UK, and moved it to its current home at South Bank. While at the National, he directed more than 300 plays just there alone from 73 to 88, the 25 years he was there. He championed Samuel Beckett. That was his first claim to fame. He did Waiting for Godot in London, and that turned him and Peter Brooks into, you know, household names. He championed Harold Pinter. He was married to actress Leslie Caron, who had an affair with Warren Beatty, so who could blame her? And one of my two great stories, he opened the National when they moved to South Bank with a production of an obscure play by Goldoni that I've never even heard of. And apparently this production was so boring, even Queen Elizabeth was seen yawning. And she never yawns in public, you know, so that's pretty bad. And of course, he was progressive and liberal. A furious Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher once said to her arts minister, "When can we stop giving money to awful people like Peter Hall?" So there you go. He had a fascinating career, major talent. I've seen a number of his work. Battled depression all his life, which was interesting to hear. So, you know, a real loss to the theater community.
Well, sadly, that's the end of three great careers in the entertainment industry. And it is the end of our show, which kind of documents the last week in the entertainment industry. Of course, you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You usually can find our show there, and we do ask that you subscribe and rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do that. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where we can be found at facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, who was just calling Michael. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's abbottandcostello.net, which is a real website.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. It's a kind of a reference to our box office segment.
That's right. Our homage to Who's on First. And next week we'll be covering the theater in the guise of several sketches from An Evening with Nichols and May. You're going to play May.
Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's entertainment coverage there, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Say goodnight, Sperling.
Good night, Sperling.